Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Banafsha Kainush, your moderator for today, for today's program, Trump and the Middle East. Looking at President Trump's performance in the past 100 days or so, it's fair to say that one sees elements of continuity and also perhaps a sterner shift of policy, though not necessarily a significant change. Starting with Iran, there is a 90-day revision period of the Iranian nuclear agreement that has begun. But yet, just this past weekend in Vienna, when a U.S. delegation sat across the table with the Iranians, there seemed to be a firm commitment that is ongoing to the nuclear agreement until we see what happens with the revision that is currently taking place in Washington. The sanctions regime on Iran is still partially on, but so are sales and business. And I think that the United States is generally adamant not to shift the outcome of the elections that is coming up late in May in Iran in favor of hardliners. When we look at Syria, there seems to be a purposeful sort of pickup of bombing, but it's still restrained. And not only did the United States, as you all know, recently went in and targeted Syria after the chemical attacks that occurred there, but Israel has done that recently in the outskirts of Damascus. At the same time, we see that there's a continued compromise. Right after the United States targeted Syria, there were conversations between Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and the Russians, and a restraint has been called for, and the United States seems to be willing to listen to everyone. The issue of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad's future, is still debatable. The United States is still continuing the fight against the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. And yet, in Iraq, the Hashd al-Shaabi, or these groups, Shia groups, that seem to be close to Iran, are also helping release some IS-held territories. This is still ongoing. In Syria, Turkey is still targeting the Kurdish groups. And although Washington has hesitations with both the Hashd al-Shaabi and with the Turkish conduct in Syria, it seems that, you know, both the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Turks are sort of continuing with their own policies unabated. Iraq and Turkey are both building a smoother dialogue with the United States. There's no doubt about that since President Trump assumed office. There's talk, for example, in Iraq of sort of building resorts, I've heard. I think everyone is in favor of that. The Iranians have for a very long time been busy with the construction business in Iraq. And I know more recently, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has been invited back into Iraq to take on a more proactive position regarding the advancement of business interests in Iraq, perhaps to create some balance between the Iranian foothold there and the Arab foothold there. When we look at Palestine, President Trump has been apparently open to more than one solution to the outcome of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And he seems also willing to hear everyone. There is a postponement of the issue of turning Jerusalem into the capital for Israel. And I think that the Trump administration is also on decent terms with Fatah in the West Bank to, in part, try to bring Hamas in Gaza more in line. And President Trump is working smoothly with Egypt, which in no small part has an important role to play in influencing Hamas. And U.S. relations with the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, particularly the United Arab Emirates and, again, Saudi Arabia, are going very smoothly. These countries are very ambivalent about the Iranian regional influence, but at the same time, they have supported the nuclear agreement with Iran as a way of maintaining stability in the region. And President Trump, I think, has been influenced by that sort of outlook by our allies in the region. In Yemen, again, purposeful bombing has picked up against Al-Qaeda, against other groups. But at the same time, there is also a pickup of humanitarian assistance. I was really impressed to learn that out of a $2 billion pledged humanitarian aid to Yemen, $1.2 billion of that sum has actually already been placed on the table, which, you know, speaking from some experience in this area, I will tell you people pledge a lot and then nothing happens. So this is huge, and I think in no small measure, thanks to Saudi Arabia, which has picked up the humanitarian policies in Yemen, given the fact that it's also there present militarily and that its military presence has come under a lot of scrutiny, as we all know. Now, there is some decent balance ongoing in the Middle East, but will it hold? One could say possibly, given that North Korea is also giving us a hard time, and we probably don't want to see tensions rise with both North Korea and countries in the Middle East at the same time. This sternness in the Trump presidency in terms of conducting policy can project a sense of purpose and determination. But is that really the case? Or, as Walid Faris, who is a pro-Trump strategist and advisor, just said today, is the 100 days of the Trump presidency important specifically because there has been a shift of narrative? Has that shift of narrative occurred? Is that all? With these questions, it's my pleasure now to introduce our distinguished panel. Alon Sakar is a Middle East peace advisor and co-author with Senator George Mitchell of A Path to Peace. Dr. Maher Khalaji, who is originally from Jordan, is a frequent contributor to Middle East forum events, as is Eddie Simonian, and a Syrian Christian from Lebanon whose master's thesis was on Lebanon's sectarian conflict. Each panelist will make a brief statement before we begin the question and answer period. We'll begin with Alon Sakar, followed by Eddie Simonian and Dr. Khalaji. Please.
You know, there's not much to say in the first 100 days, especially on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is the part of the Middle East I know best. President Trump came into office with a major advantage that his two predecessors didn't have. When President Bush came into office, shortly thereafter, intifada broke out, and major violence erupted throughout the West Bank and in Gaza. And he had a crisis that he had to deal with. Similarly, President Obama came into office after a very destructive war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And he came into office needing to deal with crisis. Those moments of crisis test a presidency. They help shape policy. They help set the tone. And they create a sense of urgency to figure out a way to bring stability to the region and to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. President Trump hasn't had to deal with anything like that yet. So right now, he hasn't necessarily had to have any decisions forced. He hasn't necessarily had to come down on anything strongly. He made a lot of statements, obviously, in the campaign that were concerning to people who are interested in a two-state solution, but also some that gave people a little bit of hope that he might be willing to come down on the parties and try and get them to some kind of agreement. That's all to say, we don't really know what's going to happen going forward, and we don't really know exactly what the administration's policies are going to be. There are tensions also within the administration itself. As everybody, I'm sure, knows, the new U.S. ambassador to Israel, which was recently confirmed, he has views that are or that at one point were very much aligned with some of the more right-wing parties in Israel. But he doesn't shape U.S. policy. And in fact, being in at the embassy in Tel Aviv, he's outside of Washington where that policy is actually shaped. I worked out of the embassy in Tel Aviv for a while I was at the State Department. And I know, you know, you're part of those conversations from Tel Aviv, but you're not kind of around the table when certain decisions are being made. And there are other things to look out for on the horizon, and I'll leave it at that. The first is Palestinian internal politics are heating up, and they will continue to remain very interesting in the coming years. President Abbas is in his mid-80s. There's a lot of conversation about succession. There's a lot of wrangling internally within his own party and other parties about what that will look like. His conflict with Hamas, Fatah's conflict with Hamas, continues to go back and forth. Just yesterday or today, President Abbas announced that he would stop paying for Gaza's electricity, which was a way to put pressure on Hamas as well. And also within Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu now has been in office for about 8 years, longer than any prime minister, period, I think, but at least in recent memory. And he also is feeling a lot of internal pressures. There was a crisis about a month ago in which he almost called for early elections over something quite inconsequential, but he thought that generating that kind of controversy was a way to take some of the heat off of himself. So there are a lot of things that are going to change in the coming, you know, who knows when, but certainly in the coming years and during this term of the Trump presidency. And coming back to the issue of crisis, it's when those things happen and when there is that change and how those are dealt with is when we'll be able to really assess what the administration's priorities are and how we separate that from the rhetoric that we hear.
Thank you very much. Our next panelist.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to start by talking about Trump and Lebanon. Lebanon, as people may or may not know, is a country that has been hampered by sectarian strife. Yet, when Trump was on his campaign, he did what Lebanese couldn't do for a century. He united Lebanon. He had people on both sides support him, whether you're pro-Syria Bashar al-Assad or whether you're right-wing pro-Christian resistance, you supported him. For the reasons that he was, during the campaign, he supported Bashar al-Assad. He said, I'm not going to intervene, I'm going to let him be. So his supporters in Lebanon were very happy, saying that we have a president that's going to come into power that will not interfere in Syria. While at the same time, the Christians in Lebanon loved him because he said he's going to attack Iran, he's going to go after Iran, he's going to remove the nuclear deal that we had with them. So that emboldened them because of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And as we go into his policy within Lebanon, we have to understand the actors within Lebanon, mainly Hezbollah. Hezbollah has had a bloody history with the United States going back to the 1980s. In 1983, the predecessor to Hezbollah, the Islamic Jihad, detonated suicide bombs against the U.S. barracks in Beirut, killing 241 American servicemen. This was the largest attack outside of U.S. soil by a terrorist organization, and it was taken by Imad Mughniyeh. He was the head of Hezbollah's operation at the time until 2008. And this continued a year later. They kidnapped the CIA station chief in Lebanon, tortured him, sent videos of the torture to the CIA headquarters. And the story goes that officer after officer kept showing these videos to the new recruits to let them know what Hezbollah did to their station chief over there, to not forget. But as we talk about that, what happened was, I'll sidetrack a bit, tell an interesting story. It's like a novel from Ian Fleming, but Imad Mughniyeh was actually assassinated in Syria in 2008. And the story goes that CIA handlers in Syria were put a bomb inside a tire. And just at the right moment, when he was passing by a car, they detonated the bomb and immediately killed him, ending that history with the Hezbollah. But Hezbollah's influence goes beyond Lebanon. It goes to Syria, it goes to Iraq, it goes to Yemen, even Israel. And as many people would know, Hezbollah is the arm of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And they commit all these crimes, whether in Argentina, 1993 bombing of the Israeli embassy in Argentina, whether bombings in Lebanon, bombings in Syria and Iraq, support for the Houthis in Yemen. A month ago, 26 Qatari hostages were released from Iraq, and Hezbollah of Lebanon intervened to facilitate their release. That's how much influence they have outside of Lebanon. So now we go back to Trump's policy and what he's doing. Since he took office, a new law is coming into effect. The law is the Hezbollah International Financing Prevention Amendments Act. And this is a very different... He's taken a different approach than his predecessor on this aspect. Obama did put sanctions against Hezbollah and people who financed them. But this new act is going to go against their allies. So he's going farther. He's going against their political allies in Lebanon, any institution, even charitable institutions, anything that has to do with Hezbollah is going to be attacked under this amendment. So banks in Lebanon right now are under a lot of pressure to figure out how to deal with the situation because Hezbollah is part of society. It's part of everyday life over there. So they're putting their allies, the U.S. allies, and their enemies in Lebanon in a very compromising situation. So this new act actually already was successful. In Morocco, a few months back, one of the biggest financiers of Hezbollah was arrested and immediately deported to the United States by the CIA. So it's already working over there. Now, looking at his policy towards Lebanon and Syria and a bit towards Iran, we have to understand the situation over there and the dynamics. Sanctions do work. Sanctions do work in Lebanon. Hezbollah financially has been decimated from where it was before. Sanctions worked against Iran also because Iran's financing to Hezbollah also was decimated. So this is a big deal when the sanctions were happening. We really hurt Hezbollah. We really hurt Iran in that aspect of their influence. But now you look at the situation in Syria and you look how Hezbollah is in Syria. The cynic within me would think that Trump's administration's best option would be let the enemies over there go after it, bleed themselves out. Hezbollah has 8,000 fighters in Syria, 1,500 dead, thousands injured. This is very, very damaging to Hezbollah. It's not an army. It's not an army that could sustain thousands and thousands of death. Every day there's someone being returned to Lebanon killed. So this is a big issue. And as we know, that Hezbollah's reach also comes to the United States. They're financing in the United States. They have deals with cartels. So anything that could harm them should be okay. What Trump did by trying to attack Syria and trying to go after Syria, I'm against that policy for the simple fact that I think it's too little too late. Obama had a chance to do something in Syria. Now Trump, if he wants to intervene in Syria, it's going to be very messy and you're going to have to put soldiers in there. The situation is not going to be, there's not going to be a clear-cut winner. And coming from a person whose family and community in Lebanon despises Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, I remember as a kid, there were protests against him where I live once I was part of it. So we hate the guy, but the current situation over there, you have to work with them. You cannot just turn a blind eye and try to go attack and try to resolve the situation over there without working with them. Because we have to take into account 30% of the population in Syria is minorities, Alawites and Christians and Druze. And a large portion of them support him. And he even has support within the Sunni community. So these situations need to be taken into account to make sure that whatever happens in Syria, we take this faction into account and make certain that things go according to plan. And I just want one last point I want to make. And I know Obama took a lot of heat for not doing anything, for not intervening in Syria, but he followed what Reagan did. When 241 soldiers died in Lebanon, what did Reagan do? Nothing. He did nothing. There was no retaliation. There was nothing going on. So I think it's unfair to demonize Obama and not look in the past and look at what Reagan did and other presidents who did nothing, yet demonize Obama and Hillary Clinton for Benghazi and other situations. And I'll end it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll invite our next panelist.
I'm going to be slightly different in my approach to what the others have said. I see worrying signs, and hopefully these are only like teething problems, but I doubt it very much. 60 days ago, which was 39 days into the Trump's presidency, we had a discussion here in this room, in the Middle East Forum, about the same subject that we're reviewing today. I did mention at the time, and people who are here would remember, that we are facing a new reality in the Middle East. And I quoted at the time, and don't jump and say I'm just picking on this person, I'm just using him as an example. I quoted at the time the education minister of Israel, who is the leader of the right-wing Jewish Home Party, Naftali Bennett, as an example of someone who's rejoicing at Trump's election win. He said, and I quote, "We have the chance to reset the structure of the Middle East." I believe he may have been referring to the Israeli-Palestinian problem specifically. But I don't think that his statement actually did apply to the whole of the Middle East as opposed just to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I'll explain why I believe so. Now, 99 days later, and today is 99 days of Mr. Trump's election, presidency, he is very popular in the governing coalition in Israel, as expected. But he's also riding extremely high in many Arab countries. He is referred to both affectionately by his friends there and in a derogatory manner by his foes as Abu Ivanka al-Amriki. That's the father of Ivanka the American. Just like you would say the leader of IS is called Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, or the ex-leader of the dead one now, who's of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, we have Abu Ivanka al-Amriki. So what has prompted this change? What has prompted this to happen? I'll give you a very brief of my opinion about this because we're running out of time. But since his inauguration, he has received a host of Arab kings and leaders in there, in the White House. He received King Hussein twice, once in the White House and once in a different place. And they praised Jordan for its fight against Daesh or IS, the Israeli-Palestinian problem, and the Syrian crisis. That's before the bombing of Syria. Indeed, as I will explain in a minute, Jordan is the only country which has not been affected by the reset button pushed in terms of U.S. policies in terms of the Middle East. What they have actually done is, if you're using a keyboard, they push Control-Alt-Delete, or the reset button, and they started back 15, 20 years ago. Jordan had escaped that. So he met with the president of Egypt, Field Marshal Sisi, who replaced in a coup d'etat the first democratically elected president of Egypt. It was a meeting of the Mutual Admiration Society. And Trump showered him with praise in contrast to the frosty relationship that Sisi had had with Obama. Forgotten are all the human rights violations committed in the name of national security. The White House now is seeking to improve the tone of the relationship with Egypt, boost military and economic cooperation, and they praised Sisi's economic reforms. Then there was a visit by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, two countries which Obama had big issues with in regards to human rights, the relationship had been strengthened. In Yemen, which in my opinion is the definition of a human disaster, they should change the dictionary so as Yemen equals human disaster. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia are delighted with the change of heart. I only have to quote what Major General Asiri of the Saudi Armed Forces and spokesman of the Gulf Coalition said. He said, "At least now we understand that the government of the United States sees the reality on the ground and that there is a country in the area that wants to use militias and spoil the situation," referring to Iran. The United Arab Emirates ambassador to the USA stated, "Now we," and he was referring to the United States, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, "are back on the same page. We're getting the support we need." This is what I mean by resetting the relationships. You may agree or disagree, but the strike on Syria may have delighted a lot of people, but certainly worried Jordan and Egypt in private, because they were both calling for a political solution to the issue, to the Syrian crisis. Is the administration, the questions they're asking, is the administration keen on removing the Assad regime now? We're not sure. Is it a priority that wiping IS off the face of the earth now, as President Trump said during the campaign trail? And an interesting point which my esteemed colleague here referred to is, how is the conflict with the situation in Iraq where the US is helping fight ISIS, how is that situation coming along, particularly with the help of Iran? They're both fighting the same enemy. So is my enemy's enemy my friend? Cue Iran. I've been serious conflicting messages about Iran. I only need three more minutes. Using hostile rhetoric, the USA has reassured the Sunni states that it will stand with them. It will not be idle. And in the middle of April, as my colleague said, the Trump administration told Congress, as they're supposed to do every 90 days, that Iran was abiding by the JCPOA. JCPOA is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. You may know it as the nuclear deal, the Iran nuclear deal. But then Tillerson jumps up and says the policy towards Iran is under review and it's a major sponsor of terrorism. Okay. But one must remember that the JCPOA has been anchored in a resolution of the United Nations Security Council, and as such is legally binding on all countries in the world, not only on the parties which have negotiated it. You only have to check that. Therefore, it cannot be denounced unilaterally. Even security experts in Israel said that it can contain the Iran problem for now. And it's also reported that Saudi Arabia is advising Trump not to abandon it. On a lighter note, I was looking at some Twitter pages, and there's one of them which appears, hashtag make the Middle East great again. And there are lots and lots of people in the Middle East, Arabs, of all religious backgrounds, who are supporting this. You know, one has to step back from this and immediately notice that there's hardly any coherent policy at the moment, which is missing. We don't know where we're going or coming. And I only have to quote one last thing. The UK ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, who recently said that if Assad were to go forcibly, Syria will implode and there will be a bloodbath, and that moderate opposition does not exist in Syria. We need comprehensive policies on what we see, what will happen in all of these places. You know, I used to use the Israeli-Palestinian problem as, refer to it as the bellwether of US policy in the Middle East. If you don't know what a bellwether is, not actually what it means, but where it comes from, bell is from a bell, and weather is the term for a castrated male sheep. So a castrated lamb.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Now, we have the Israeli conflict continuing. We're seeing still the ugly face of Shia-Sunni sectarianism in Iraq, the civil war in Syria, the proxy wars between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the collapse of Libya, the sinking ship of Yemen. My conclusion is that there are too many castrated rams with bells around their necks pulling the U.S. foreign policy all over the place. The conflicts of Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and the Israeli-Palestinian problem have one thing in common. They can be resolved through political means only. In all these countries, all these conflicts, there is no military solution to any of these problems. And I just finish by saying that the art of diplomacy must not be replaced by the art of the deal. Thank you.
Thanks to our very distinguished panelists for their comments. Now it's time for the question and answer period. We have a large number of questions, so let's begin. From what I gather from this panel, there is definitely a fair degree of uncertainty about the Trump presidency. But I would posit here that this uncertainty has always been in place whenever a new U.S. president takes office. And oftentimes, the new presidents take on, in the very end, become very practical, one or two issues that they feel they can tackle with, deal with it, and then let the rest flow on to the next administration. Having said that, how much certainty can we create in our panel today about what to see in a Trump presidency? I want to begin with Yemen. We know that a lot is happening there, but at the same time, the Houthis, who are meeting in Geneva very soon again, and there are renewed efforts for a negotiation with the help of Saudi Arabia, with the help of the UAE, the United States. So there is effort underway to try to at least contain the conflict over there. And we know that there are efforts underway to contain a lot of other Middle East conflicts. What is your opinion, and this question is to all our three panelists, about the Trump presidency's efforts at being pragmatic in containing conflicts in the Middle East rather than escalating them?
Are you looking at me? Okay, you mentioned Yemen as an example, and I just came across a report that the Trump White House is looking to resume missile sales, which were frozen by Obama, to Saudi Arabia. It's also considering intelligence and planning support for an Emirati-led offensive to retake one of the ports, which is important for military and humanitarian aspects. And it's enough to say that one spokesman for General Mattis told the Voice of America that the Trump administration does not believe that the Houthis will return to the negotiating table without more military pressure. So I think that contradicts that statement.
Well, when I go into Yemen to specifically about that, I just think what they're doing with their support to Saudi Arabia and the weapon sale, as Maher mentioned, is counterintuitive. The Houthis are not going to back down. When you have someone backed into a corner and they feel that their existence is at stake, which is what they feel that a sea of Sunni around them is coming to get them, they're not going to back down. So you need to have someone to mediate there, to make, you know, to enter and have an honest mediation. And the United States is not the person. And frankly, I don't know who would be in the Middle East that both sides would trust to do this. So the situation is very precarious. And I don't think it's fair to put the U.S. administration on the spot on this one, because regardless of who is in power, it is going to be that type of situation. You know, at the end, they're in, and as bad as it sounds, they need to find a solution with the least amount of blood.
Alan Sakhar, can you say a little bit about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and this question that I posed? And also in light of the fact that Jerusalem status as a capital is still sort of pending, and as one of the audience has correctly underscored, seen as quite a provocation at the current moment. What do you think?
Well, first, to answer your broader question about, you know, how about whether they're going to manage and maintain or try and resolve some of these conflicts, I think it's really important to keep in mind that the very people that the Trump administration will be relying on to do this aren't even in place. I mean, you have massive amounts of vacancies at the agencies where this needs to happen. So it's one thing for the president or anybody at the White House to announce some kind of policy, but you need the people to carry that out. You need there's not even an assistant secretary of state for the Middle East yet. It's still a holdover, somebody who's acting. And so for all of these conflicts, I mean, it gets incredibly difficult to do anything coherent, to implement any kind of coherent strategy if you don't have the people in place that need to implement that and to tee up the decisions that are necessary to implement that. As to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there's been some news today about Jerusalem specifically and what the president may or may not do. Obviously, you know, throughout history, presidents on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, have said that they would move the embassy to Jerusalem, the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. They would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And every president has not done that because the risks of doing that turns out outweighs any of the benefits that might be received. We don't know what Trump's going to do. He made some elusive comments recently about, ask me about this in a month when he'll be on his trip. He's planning a visit to Israel. So we don't know. There are things that can be done, to mitigate some of the ramifications of that. To be honest, the policy on Jerusalem, if I explain it to you in detail, is a little bit incoherent, just because, you know, the U.S. doesn't recognize any sovereign in Jerusalem. And that makes sense, because either we recognize one party has the full right to Jerusalem, or we recognize, for example, that Israel controls West Jerusalem and that West Jerusalem is Israel's capital. But by doing that, you are necessarily saying that you do not recognize their control in East Jerusalem. So the policy is such where we're just not taking a position. So it'll be interesting to see how the Trump administration shapes this. Several people mentioned that President Trump has very good relations with some of the Arab countries in the Gulf. And they are not going to stay quiet about this issue, not because they necessarily feel they have personal stakes in this, but they know those kinds of emotional issues, issues that could bring people to the streets throughout the region, also threaten their ability to control domestically what happens in their countries. And that is an interest that everybody in the region is going to have. Yeah.
We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Trump and the Middle East. Our panelists are Alon Sakhar, Dr. Maher Khalaji, and Eddie Simonian. I'm Banaf Shekenush, your moderator. To follow up on this last question, I want to turn the panel's attention to Syria. If indeed we are uncertain about a lot of things that we feel there might be a degree of certainty on ongoing as well, then what do we have to say about Syria, especially in light of the recent targeting of Syria by the United States? Can any of you shed light on what you believe was the motivation behind that single operation?
I'll take that. I think, honestly, it just goes down to Trump wanting to differentiate himself from Obama when Obama drew a red line and did nothing. And Trump just wants to say that he actually did something, and something that's minimal and would not change the game in Syria. And that's what happened. And as we know, a strike just happened in Syria yesterday by Israel. And Israel continually strikes Syria, but this is a policy for them to attack Hezbollah. So what the United States did, even though it was a big deal in the news and they attacked Syria, but really is not a game changer. It did nothing on the ground. It was simply for show. It was simply for, he's a showman, you know, like he loves to let people know that he's doing something. So that's something for him to say that Obama drew a red line, did nothing. When this happened, I directly acted and did something, but it's nothing on the ground.
Alon Sakhar, do you agree that this was a show or was there more to it?
I think that certainly plays into it, but I don't necessarily think that that was the main motivation. I do think that there are plenty of people in the administration, but also civilian bureaucrats, people in the Department of Defense, who recognize the importance of drawing some kinds of lines, making sure people implement or to protect international norms. Obviously, hundreds of thousands of people have been affected by the Syria conflict, and comparatively, the amount of people who died in the gas attack was quite low, but it was the fact that those kinds of chemicals were used. I also think that Russian involvement in Syria and U.S.-Russian relations had something to do with it. So I think there are a mix of reasons that the Trump administration felt it was important to do that.
Dr. Khalaji, could you tell us what the effect of the Muslim ban is in all this picture and the discussions we have? And also in light of the Syrian refugee crisis and U.S. policy to sort of still maintain a limit on the number of refugees that it will take from Syria, how does this all play into the Arab-U.S. Policies at this current juncture of time?
Whew, that's another 45 minutes.
Well, we'll try to keep it brief.
Okay. What's interesting is that the ban on entry from, which is not enforceable at the moment, but by Trump administration on the Muslims from these countries, that ban included countries where not a single person has committed a single act of terrorism against the United States. And the UK objected to it. The German objected to it. Most of the world objected to it. Except two countries were very, very quiet about it. Saudi Arabia and Egypt. They did not mention anything. It's interesting that the main terrorist attack in the US, which was September 11th, was committed by citizens of these two states and the United Arab Emirates. Now, they went even further than that to say, well, it's an internal matter for the U.S. It's fighting terrorism. I mean, that made me laugh when they said that. They're fighting terrorism when actually nobody from these countries has committed, as I said, any terrorist act in the United States. Clearly, the Arab countries are not in a position to dictate or say anything. They even had to bend backwards when the U.S. administration banned the use of laptops, for example, on aircrafts coming from its friendly neighbors, friendly countries. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Jordan, Egypt, these are the countries where they banned the use of laptops on aircrafts, even though it's nonsensical in terms of security. So that's one thing. The issue with the refugees, I mean, the Middle East, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey are suffering tremendously with the amount of refugees that are there. And they need help, whether it's financial or resettlement of some of these refugees until the situation improves in Syria. I think the only way to resolve that issue is to actually resolve the Syrian problem and get these people back home. Nobody escapes home for no reason. These people escaped en masse. They're not terrorists. They're trying to save their families.
Thank you. We just got a comment from the audience debating whether the countries that don't do business with President Trump or have not been in business associations with President Trump are the only ones banned. But we'll just take that as a joke for the side on the side for today's very serious discussion. And I wanted to turn to Eddie Simonian again and ask that after the U.S. targeted Syria following its use of chemical weapons, what effect did that have on the internal debate in Lebanon about the Trump presidency?
So that's a good question. And again, this played out in the sectarian divide in Lebanon. So what happened is the Shias, some of the Sunnis, and some of the people who are pro Bashar al-Assad were very unhappy. But then the right-wing Christians, the people who are anti-Hezbollah, anti-Iran in Lebanon, were celebrating, saying that this is the start of a new era for the United States. This is a change of policy from Obama. You know, when Trump says something, he's going to do it, and he's going to, you know, go after Iran next. So to them, it was like a war chant that Iran's coming. Iran's turn is coming. So they were very excited.
Thank you. Alon Sahar, there's a few more questions about Israel, and especially the role that the Trump family has to play in that issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. To what extent is President Trump's son-in-law, in your opinion, qualified to address the issue of peace in the Middle East? And what happens, according to one of the questions, if Prime Minister Netanyahu may suddenly realize that President Trump, in the end, wishes to advance deal-making rather than to break deals in the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Just to say two quick things on the Muslim ban. One quick thing. You know, the focus is often on those countries and who we're not letting in. I think we also should keep in mind the impact that that's having on some communities in the United States. There have been reciprocal restrictions, for example, placed on Iranian Americans, Americans from visiting Iran. I'm from Southern California. There's a very large Iranian-American community there, and I know that they are very, very deeply affected by this. So it's, I mean, there are a whole host of issues that come out abroad, but this also has a very deep effect on communities in the United States. To answer your question about qualifications and what to expect and what the president can do, you know, I don't know what his qualifications are, to be honest, but at the same time, I don't know what mine necessarily were when I first started working at the State Department. You know, these are things that you develop and you learn over time, and so I can't necessarily say that he can't do the same thing. I also think it's important to keep in mind that the emphasis on the U.S. role is very important. And there's no substitute to the U.S. role and to an active U.S. party. But that alone is not going to do anything. We've seen that. I don't think there's been any president who, for as long, for their entire term, basically devoted as much time and energy as President Obama, or even, you know, at the end of the Bush administration, they devoted in a tremendous amount of capital. The real issue is, are the Israelis and the Palestinians interested in doing this? Can they ever trust each other to get to an agreement? And there are things that the U.S. can do to try and bridge those gaps and to get them there, but it's not a substitute. In the end, this is something that they have to solve. These are political conflicts that they have to solve. So it's interesting, and I think it will be interesting to watch, because Prime Minister Netanyahu has been so vocally supportive of President Trump. He's, in many respects, put all of his chips in that basket. And that gives President Trump a tremendous amount of leverage over him in the future, which I think will be interesting to watch. Republican presidents, every president has clashed with their Israeli counterparts, especially when the American president wanted to get something done and the Israeli prime minister did not. So I think that'll be very interesting to watch.
Very interesting. Unfortunately, we have time for only two last questions. And I want to ask Dr. Khaleji to sort of elaborate a little bit about Turkey and the question of the Kurds. The question really is from the audience, why did President Trump congratulate President Erdogan when the recent elections in Turkey happened. But my question is, well, why not? And what are we really looking at here? And to what extent does the Kurdish issue play in the Turkish-U.S. relations and in really, frankly, resolving the conflicts in Iraq and Syria, if we can? I mean, that's a huge question. If you could please just narrow your response, I would appreciate it. It would be a lot of assistance to me.
Thank you. The gentleman on my left just said good luck with that. there is a problem with Turkey. And the problem with Turkey at the moment is Erdogan. It's worrying that one of the few people who phoned him to congratulate him on the election, on the win in the referendum, is Trump. They both call themselves strong men. It is definitely worrying. And I was just reading a report just yesterday from the meeting of the EU foreign ministers in Rome to celebrate 60 years. And they specifically refer to the elections of Erdogan. And they're worried about the demise of democracy in Turkey. Now that our president is congratulating Erdogan on this, it's the word is discombobulating. I feel really discombobulated by this. They have a common issue now in terms of Syria. They're fighting for the same cause, which is defeating ISIS, but they're fighting opposite wars. The Kurds, the Turks keep on bombing the Kurds. They keep on bombing the living daylight out of them. And the Americans don't like that because they give them weapons. So as I said right at the beginning, all of these discrepancies, all of these contradictions do nothing to enhance the image of the United States overseas. There needs to be some consistency. They're acting like it's a cowboy movie, off the cuff, you know, just get the gun out and shoot, like what happened with Syria. They really need to sit down, and wise heads needs to be there. There are some. There's Mattis, there's McMaster. I don't think much of Mr. Tillerson at the moment because I don't think he has the experience in diplomacy. So I am worried at the moment as to what will happen. Turkey is just an example of this.
Thank you. And just to make the discussion more complicated, our final question is posed to all three of our panelists. Mindful of how costly waging wars are, just the cost of the missiles that go down anywhere in any of the conflict zones in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, we have very clear figures. These costs can add up to billions. President Trump's decision to cut back on some agency budgets, including as well the budget of the State Department, but really fortifying the defense. What does that mean? What does that mean in resolving conflicts or not in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, where we as the United States aim to maintain a presence? And again, this question is to all our three panelists.
I could start. So I see they're talking over here about the mother of all bombs, and going to that, I actually was reading about a book 2 days ago. It's about cartels and how cartels, unlike other organizations, instead of taking people to court, they send a message by killing people. I really believe that what happened was a message, the mother of all bombs, a message to certain countries that we have these weapons that even if you're hiding in bunkers in North Korea, wherever you are, we could go after your elites and everything. As for Yemen and these countries, I really do not believe that it is a priority for this administration. They don't worry about that. They're leaving it to Saudi Arabia, and I think that's why their allies over there like them. Saudi Arabia, UAE, and these countries feel that the United States, as with Trump in power, is going to give them more leeway to dictate their policy, their neighborhood policy over there, and also they feel that they could influence Trump pertaining to Iran. So the defense budget, I think, is aimed at one part of the world and not aimed at, and by them cutting the aid, it is consistent with their policy of
not worrying about what's happening in certain parts of the world. They even removed special forces from Central Africa that were going after the Lord's Rebel Army. So we just it's just a change of policy, I believe, and they're concentrating on, you know, the Pacific, North Korea, and countries over there, and I think it's just a message to them. And as far as diplomacy in the Middle East and these countries, I think they're moving away from that.
Thank you, Eddie Simonian. Alon Sahar, do you have anything to add?
I'll just say, you know, there's obviously the famous saying, and I'm going to butcher it, that, you know, the fewer diplomats you have, the more soldiers you're going to end up needing. And so I think the cuts, especially to the State Department, are incredibly concerning. But not all the diplomats at the State Department conduct diplomacy and negotiations between different nations. A lot of the work that the State Department does on the ground, English training, cultural exchanges, bringing people from foreign countries to the United States to meet Americans, to make connections with Americans, to study in the U.S., these programs reap benefits for decades and decades. Having people come to the United States, experience, you know, us as a country, leaves an impression. And oftentimes these people go on to great success in their own countries, positions of leadership in their own countries. So these kinds of budget cuts are incredibly problematic, also from the standpoint of building relations between countries.
Dr. Khaji, briefly, do you have a comment to make?
Very briefly, and I mean, I finished my presentation by saying that all these conflicts, in whether it's Syria, wherever it is, there is no military solution to these conflicts. And I would just finish by the words of the EU Foreign Affairs spokesman, Federica Mogherini, again at that meeting in Rome. And they use the term change through trade. That brings peace. I think this is something which we should really consider. Change in these places through trade, not through bombing the living daylight out of places.
Thanks to our distinguished panelists for today's presentation of Trump and the Middle East. We also thank our audiences here, those listening to the recording and on the internet. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.